I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Starting a business on your own can be lonely and worrying. Selling online multiplies this issue tenfold. Getting expert help is a great way to reduce anxiety, wasted time, and confusion. The Amazing FBA Mentoring Program is in its fourth year of helping sellers to get started on Amazon. By now, we have former clients who have, starting from scratch, done six figures and even in one case, seven figures a year. Obviously, these are not typical results. These are exceptional people. Nevertheless, we can help you get launched faster, safer, and with a much higher chance overall of success. With clients from Melbourne, Australia to Manchester, England, we bring a genuinely international perspective. To find out more, go to amazingfba.com/mentoring. Thanks for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Amazing FBA podcast, the place to be for UK-based Amazon sellers. Actually, an awful lot of our listeners that find value in it are Americans as well, and not to say Germans, Indians, Canadians seem to be the main constituents. We seem to have a download in pretty much every country, but maybe like one person in Albania or something. So if you're in Albania, welcome. And welcome to the show. Today, we are talking to Steve Anderson, who is the author of a new book, The Bezos Letters, 14 Principles to Grow Your Business Like Amazon. So a bit of a different take on Amazon. Unsurprisingly, Jeff Bezos' approach to Amazon is also a good approach for anyone who's selling on Amazon, but it goes bigger than that. So it's a slightly different big picture sort of question that we're dealing with in this show. So, Steve, warm welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Good to see you as well. And the nice thing about you, Steve, is that you're not an Amazon seller. So you have an outsider's perspective on it, which I think every so often is incredibly important to get. So just give us a very quick background about yourself, where you come from, what you've been doing professionally.
Yeah, professionally, for the last probably 35 plus years, I've been in the insurance industry. The last 20 years of those, excuse me, I've been looking at technology and how it interacts with that industry. So new emerging technologies, what are the changes? Just like any other business that's looking at websites and how to do social media and marketing and write all those kinds of things. But I've been focused on the insurance industry.
So how does that bring you, how do you get from the insurance industry to writing about Jeff Bezos?
That's a really good question. Actually, I was researching an idea that I had a few years ago that the biggest risk businesses face today is actually not taking enough risk. With technology developing as fast as it is, businesses of all sizes and types, frankly, don't have the time they used to evaluate new technologies that were coming and impacting them, be that email or websites or social or even just products and services that they needed to provide to their customers. And so in that research, I was looking at businesses who had made the transition well and those that did not. And certainly some of those that did not, we may know of Kodak or Blockbuster or BlackBerry or, I mean, lots of examples there. And some examples of companies that have actually done it well. And that's where I came across Amazon and started doing research and came across the shareholder letters that Jeff Bezos has written starting in 1997. And became very fascinated with the information that he shared in there. Certainly, there was some company updates and sales and what we've done well over the last year. But he also included in there what I call hidden in plain sight, the principles he used to build Amazon. And so as I did the analysis, I actually realized and could identify 14 principles that Amazon has used to grow that I believe any business can learn from.
Excellent. So really what I'm taking from that is really the biggest risk for all businesses is not taking risks correctly. Too much software out there means it's hard for everyone to evaluate opportunities accurately. And the famous missed opportunities, Kodak ignored the digital camera. And I guess Blockbuster ignored, the sort of Netflix model, i.e. they sold videos, literally physical versions of them, and they missed the online version of that. Whereas Amazon's done a good job of that. So, and of course, the principles that Jeff Bezos has used to grow famously, Jeff Bezos, an incredible strategist of business. So that brings us to the question that I wanted to sort of pick your brains for, use your sort of risk evaluation hat very much from the outside of the Amazon sort of, what's the word? The Amazon echo chamber, as Will Chernin calls it. So everyone in Amazon, yes, talking about Amazon to other people in Amazon, evaluating the Amazon business opportunity or the idea of selling on Amazon in some form. And there are obviously lots of different ways of doing that. So from a 100,000 foot point of view, from an investing point of view, how would you go about evaluating Amazon as a business opportunity as opposed to any other place you could put your money or time or efforts?
Well, I think there's a couple things. And let's start with Marketplace, although as you know, FBA, and there are a couple of different opportunities there. But Marketplace was a radical idea when Amazon came up with it in the early 2000s. And in fact, there was strong opposition internally at Amazon for allowing third-party sellers to be on that very valuable real estate right next to Amazon products. I mean, that was the objection. Why would we allow that to happen? And I think this is, in evaluating whether Marketplace is the right place for someone to access, I think it helps to understand the reasoning behind Marketplace in the first place. And that was customer obsession. So one of my principles, it's actually the fourth principle, that what Bezos said was, if a third-party seller has a product we don't have and or is able to sell it for a price less than we can sell it, it's better for the customer. And if it's better for the customer, it will ultimately be better for Amazon and Amazon shareholders. And so they experimented. They tested. They actually tried. Marketplace was the third iteration of that idea. The first was Amazon Auctions, where they tried to compete with eBay. The second was Z Shops, where they actually allowed in a separate section of the Amazon website third-party sellers. That didn't work. Nobody wanted to log in someplace new or different. And then they added directly on the same pages, and that's what started building. And here's, Michael, where I would help people think through the opportunity, which is you don't have to build what Amazon has spent 25 years building, which is a massive online presence. You can access that. You will pay Amazon for that privilege, but you don't have to go through the infrastructure development. On the other hand, if you don't understand Amazon's obsession with the customer, how they view the customer, then you might not be successful on that platform. Meaning, you know, if there's a customer that has a problem and you're not on that problem quickly and solving that in the customer's benefit, and that doesn't mean the customer's always right, but it does mean you are focusing on what's best for them and not just your own short-term thinking, then it might not be a good opportunity. So I think when I talk to people about Marketplace, that seems to be a component that isn't well understood. And it's almost today that, you know, I have a right to be on Amazon's Marketplace. But understanding that cultural mindset, which is infused through Amazon. In fact, Bezos first writes about customer obsession in the 1997 letter. And I think that's why going back to the letters can really help you understand, one, where Amazon came from and what they've developed and where they are today.
Great. Okay. So what I'm taking from that really is that the thing you said at the beginning, I think is really, really important. There's a radical idea. And in a sense, the objection that Amazon had to having third-party sellers on the platform competing with Amazon should be the same thing. That if we're smart, we think the opposite way around. Why would we want to be on a platform where we are competing with Amazon? But I think you just said the two simple things: if third-party sellers can sell something that Amazon can't or for a better price, that means the customers benefit. Now, the flip side of that is if you can't sell something Amazon can't sell and you can't beat Amazon's price, you shouldn't be on the platform. And probably. I think that's really, you know, just to I'm slightly twisting your words, but only the flip side of what you said. And I think that's really critical because a lot of people go in and essentially try to copy what's working. Now, that's not a bad business strategy, I think. We can discuss that. But they copy what Amazon is selling, which is fatal because Amazon is already selling it, and it's their platform, so they can play by their own rules. They don't have to play by their own rules, rather. Or if somebody's able to sell something cheaper than you, then you can't compete on price. So that implies quite a lot, doesn't it?
What do you think about those things? So, yeah, I think it does, you know, yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff there. And I think that's part of having the right mindset of, yes, there are, you know, thousands of third-party sellers being very successful on the platform. And you have to also understand it is their platform. And so whether it's marketplace or whether you use FBA, right, and their fulfillment network that they've spent billions of dollars developing over the years. Again, you don't have to worry about shipping, inventory, all of those kinds of things. That could be a very net positive for anybody who wants to sell there. And there's always, you know, actually Amazon's in the news quite a bit right now with their marketplace and third-party sellers, because the allegation is they use all that data to figure out what markets they need to go into. That's always a risk also, right? If you find a niche that they haven't identified, will they come in? And what's your differentiation as a third-party seller for being on that platform? So that's the trade-off, actually, right? The risk is you're on Amazon's platform. The benefit could be you're on Amazon's platform. So being very realistic, you know, about that balance between risk and reward, I think for anybody thinking about new going on the platform, even continuing on it, is really important.
Yeah, so you talked about the balance between risk and reward. So how do we evaluate, because that seems to me that that's one of your expertise is, if there's a word, in insurance is evaluating risk, but also if your insurance companies would totally risk averse, they wouldn't ever insure anything. If they were totally, you know, careless about risk and gamblers, they'd get out of business. So presumably mm-hmm. that fine evaluation of risk and reward is the business that you're in insurance. That's why I thought you'd be a very interesting guest. So how do we evaluate that for ourselves personally?
Well, and again, I'm going to go back to what Amazon has done. And my suggestion is you experiment. You can experiment small. And one of Amazon's core values as a company is, again, what I have termed successful failure, meaning, and it's principle number one, meaning Amazon experiments all the time with new products, new services, new platforms, new whatever. They have a reasonable expectation that it's going to be successful, but they don't know for sure. In fact, an experiment by its very nature means you can fail. Because if you can't fail, it's not an experiment. And so, again, back to the marketplace. So original was auctions. They experimented. Didn't work. It failed. The next iteration was Z Shops. Experimented. Didn't work. It failed. But they kept learning until they got to something now called marketplace that did work. So in your own business, what are you experimenting with in terms of what will work or not work, and then learning from what didn't work, the failures that you can take and implement further on? And when people think about Amazon, I think they think of it as an inventive and innovative company, but there's a reason for that, and that is that failure at Amazon is not a career-ending move. You know, so that I see as, when I say the biggest risk is not taking enough risk, that's the core idea. Meaning, if an employee experiments and fails, is it a career-ending move? So I believe people don't fear failure by itself. We know we have to learn by failing. I mean, my easy example is I have 7 grandchildren now, and several of them at least are learning to walk. They fail and fall all the time, but they get back up, they learn, and they move forward. So if people don't fear failure, but people fear the consequences of failure. You know, now for a small, you know, solopreneur or a small number of people, that's a little easier to do, but it gets harder and harder as an organization grows. And that's one of the problems with scaling. So that's that managing risk, failure, and I've termed it successful failure, which is actually is typically two words that are not used together.
Absolutely. Right? I'm just reading your book recently, and Jeff Bezos said, look, I can't remember who he was referring to. He said, look, don't get me wrong. This failure is like having root canal without anesthetic. It's horrible, but it doesn't matter. Something like that.
That's right. Yeah, he does. And he said recently in the last couple years that, in fact, I think is the 2018 letter, he talks a lot about growing the size of the failures at Amazon as the size of Amazon grows. And he says, you know, we need billion-dollar failures because they don't matter, you know, which I still can't get my head around, right? So that's a scale I have a hard time understanding. But the concept there is, to move forward, as he says, to move the needle enough, you've got to take some big risks. And I think that's the twist that certainly I bring, as you said, from my background, that I think is really important for any size business to think about.
It makes a lot of sense. Now, so that's a very, very, very big picture view. I guess we've talked about the risk of Amazon selling on the platform versus that. How do we evaluate that risk a little bit more narrowly? I mean, I know we've got the book to talk about. There's a lot to talk about there, but I'd like to try and dig into that question. So I want to answer the question for people who are looking at Amazon compared to, say, I don't know, property investments. What are the other classics? Stock market investing, I guess Forex trading, or starting some other form of business. How should we make sense of this risk of the Amazon taking our best product ideas, for example, or competing with Amazon on price, that kind of
thing? Well, I think for me, the first place to start is your own expertise. You know, what do you know already, or what are you willing to learn? So if you've got expertise in you know, financial markets, stock market, things like that, that's certainly a leg up versus figuring out how to sell on an e-commerce site, which is a whole different set of skills from marketing, web presence, how are you going to get customers, right? Those kinds of things. Certainly the same idea with property investing or anything like that. So it first starts with either what skills do I already have, and or what skills am I willing to learn in order to make this investment actually work. So I think that's the first area. I think then looking at Amazon, what really is the potential? I think there are things like your show and the work that you do with helping sellers on the platform, you know, maximize their income, their revenue, maximize clients going there, right? All of those types of abilities will help someone new coming in decide, okay, where do I want to spend my time? And what's going to be the biggest return for whatever, you know, monetary investment I'm going to put into a platform? And none of them are risk-free, right? If it's risk-free, you know, the reward's not there either. So that goes back to what is your, as I phrase it, what is your risk mindset, or what is going to be your return on risk, right? So what we're talking about here is return on investment. How am I going to know if I invest this money, I'm going to get something back? I have coined a term in the book called return on risk, right? If I take this risk, what is going to be my return and the benefit to the investment I make?
Return on risk. Okay, that's quite a cool phrase. I mean, the word risk is a dirty word, I think, amongst new would-be entrepreneurs sometimes. I think probably because they'd be missold into what it is to start or run a, quotes, passive income-based business.
Right.
And I have turned away clients, even though I could have done with the money, but I just thought, I need to be honest here. Somebody said, can you give me a guarantee of a certain level of return? I said, no, and not only can I not do that, that's the wrong question for an entrepreneur. I don't think you should do this. But the other thing is that I think when you look at the opposite end of the scale, with the people that I work with in the masterminds who are doing really well and scaling really, really fast, like doubling from $5 million a year to $10 million or something in a year, you know, year on year, then they are not risk averse, but they're not gamblers. They are into calculated risk, which is the whole thing we're discussing today, right? So let's get into your book a bit more, because obviously that's the main thing that you've been focused on. Go on.
I have. And Michael, let me, before we make that transition, let me make one other quick comment. One of the things, and I talk some about it in the book, but one of the things when you're looking at risk is what can you do to protect the downside? Meaning, are there things you can put in place today? So I will say, I think one of the downsides of being on Marketplace is, frankly, Amazon could get mad at you and just cut you off, right? If you're not doing something they think you should be doing, that's a risk. So what can you do, even getting in the very beginning, to protect if you have identified, which I think is a risk, what can you do to protect that downside? And knowing that going in will help you manage that a little bit better. So that just came to mind as you were finishing that. So yeah, I'd love to talk about the book too.
Of course, and you're quite right. I mean, think protecting the downside. Yeah, Amazon suspension risk is a tricky one. I mean, everyone talks about this ad nauseum. I think that the classic answer to that is setting up a Shopify store. And that's that. If nothing else, I think that proves to you how valuable Amazon is, because suddenly you've got to find traffic and make the economics of that work, which is really, really hard, which reminds you why Amazon's a great opportunity. But also, I think people get a bit obsessed with finding an e-commerce answer to e-commerce risk. I think one of the answers I would say that's quite commonsensical and that I see again in real life with a lot of people on Amazon, their e-commerce business is very, very focused on Amazon. And that is a big risk, but their entire economic life as individual people who own part or all of the business is not, because they have property and they may have other businesses as well. In fact, in many cases they do. So I would just flag out that you don't have to make your entire business necessarily Amazon. So completely de-risk your business. You can accept that your business is a high gain, high risk venture. If you grow it really big, then there's more to lose. And at that point, yes, you might want to diversify. But the reality is, most businesses that I know that are really successful on Amazon aren't very diversified. Some are, but that's a different skill set. I would just point out the easier way, if you're not super, super clever e-commerce seller, and you know, Shopify is really a difficult model. It can work very well, but it's really hard. Go buy a property with your Amazon profits from Christmas. And then if you get suspended in February, you know, or March, then you've got and have a lot of cash in the bank is the other thing to say, that a lot of the best businesses just have a ton of cash. I mean, Microsoft famously has a year's worth of outgoings in the bank. And again, you know, they don't control the US regulatory authorities when the Monopolies and Mergers Commission in the UK or the antitrust legislation starts sniffing around and breaking your company up. But you can control how much money you leave in the bank, right? So I think a couple of really very kind of industrial, what's the word, agricultural responses. But trust me, having gone around this question with a lot of very smart people a lot of times, there is no simple answer. If we had one, we'd be creating the next Amazon, I think. Except that what you're doing is high risk. And then, you know, the other thing is that an individual product line risk, which is a lot different, is how much of your capital you allocate to any individual product line, I would say. It's the other thing. Agreed. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, and then you're, you know, that's just obvious, but it's just diversification of risk. I mean, that's the other thing. But I feel that that's been probably talked about quite a lot. Let's get onto these, your book, because I'm interested in the basic principles that you pulled out, because I think they could apply to all businesses. The four growth cycles, you've mentioned that there are four growth cycles, at least mentioned it to me. I know that's the structure of your book. What are those growth cycles that you've identified from Jeff Bezos's thinking?
Yeah, the cycles are test, build, accelerate, and scale. Okay. And I believe any business of any size is continually going through those cycles. Certainly a new business is going to be initially in the test and build cycles. And again, we've got different principles in each of those. As a business grows or gets bigger, they go into accelerate and scale. And scale is not just for big, you know, huge businesses. It's for any business that has gone through that initial growth stage and wants to be a sustainable business. And so those cycles and different, you know, for larger organizations, different departments or product lines could be going through those cycles at different times.
But I wanted to say as well that there's no given, I guess, that this happens, does it? Because I suppose you could test, build, accelerate, fail to scale, don't test, don't build anything, and just die. And it sounds like a really stupid thing to say, but a lot of people do that with an Amazon-based business, or rather they get one, maybe two products up, they do okay, and they don't do anything. Or they do, but only when it goes horribly wrong. Then they phone me up and go, Mike, why are my sales dropping off a cliff? And then I'll look at it and go, well, because you didn't really plan to scale it in the first place. So I think Amazon more than anywhere else in the world, you're either growing or you're dying, because it's so hyper-competitive. There's always new competition coming in. So I think if people, for example, don't launch properly, they don't have an aggressive plan to grow their sales over the first 2-3 weeks on the platform, then what happens is Amazon gives you a bit of a honeymoon period, and then it goes, right, we've given you a chance. You're not really converting the traffic we're sending you, so we're not going to bother sending you traffic.
Sending traffic, that brutal. Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of that brutal. So I just wanted to point out that the first thing is to have the ambition to grow before you even get into the growth cycles. But having said that, and I think, you know, grow or die basically needs to be your mantra in business generally, but on Amazon, you have no choice. Trust me, it's not a place to just do this, you know, set your business up and then go off to the beach in Bali. If you notice anyone who has the story of doing that, you can do that for about 12 months. And then those people sell their businesses, and then they have a nice, lovely story to tell. Look, I set this up, passive income for 12 months, and I sold it. Yes, that works for 12 months. Don't try this for 4 years. That's what I would say. Growth is essential. So,
well, and I was going to say that really points to one of the principles. It's principle 5, which is apply long-term thinking.
Okay.
And if there's anything about Amazon and Bezos, it's that they think long-term. So your point of, you need to be thinking, 5 years down the road, where you want to be and how you're going to get there. And that is one of the reasons Amazon is the size and scale it is today. And let me say that I think people forget that 25 years ago, Jeff Bezos was on his hands and knees packing books to mail and taking them to the post office for people who had bought these books online. He started out where every business starts out. And he obviously did scale. But in the 1997 letter, he has this phrase that caught my attention early on, that where he says, we are building something that we can tell our grandchildren about. Well, he was young, he had young kids, who wasn't even, grandchildren were years away. He was already thinking about what he was building that he could tell his grandchildren about. And I think that's really supports what you were just saying. Go into this with a longer term than I just need to make some money for the next year.
Absolutely. I mean, what you can do, let this be fair, not everyone's going to think about their grandchildren. I know a couple of people in our masterminds who are like several generations into their family businesses, and they're now selling on Amazon. So in those cases, they literally probably want to be thinking about what they're going to be passing on to their grandchildren, quite literally. But for the rest of us, if you're going to sell in 3 years' time, that's fine. You've got a 3-year horizon, maybe 5 to be safe, but that's not the same as 3 months. I mean, and you cannot set up a business that will work well for a year if you want to sell it in 3 years. So even that is not exactly long term, but it's longer term than most people think. Trust me, most people are focused on the next 12 months. And then after that, they really don't know what they're doing in my experience. I mean, when I'm talking about people who are new to Amazon now, I don't mean the established business owners, many of whom that I know have 10-year plans, in fact.
Yes.
It sounds crazy, but they do, and they've got cash flow projections for 10 years. I mean, this is not common, but the really successful ones, they have it. I mean,
That's the key. What you said is the really successful ones are thinking in those terms.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're going to sell a business to somebody, okay, you want to sell in 3 years' time, but the person who's buying it doesn't necessarily want to sell it immediately. They may be looking to flip it, but the chances are they may want to roll it up and put it into something else. So you've got to leave some meat on the bone, as they say, when you sell a business, but you've got to have a growth story from the past. But the only reason a new owner would be interested in that is the growth story of the future. So you've had 3 years of growth. Great. Why are they interested in that? Because it implies you're going to have the next 10 years of growth as well, right? So they're buying the future. So in other words, if you have a future plan, it makes your business more sellable. And granted, it's got to be based on real past numbers. You can't just have a story, but there's got to be a trajectory, if you like, that you're building into the business, that you're creating a brand in a certain space, like you're selling cookware products. You've got to have a brand where you could cross sell or upsell people. You have the possibility of creating a viable Shopify store with a suite of products that you're creating, that you have customer email lists, that you have stuff that has future potential for expanding the business, right?
So, no question.
I, I really think that people miss that bit. Just because you're selling the business in 3 years' time, you're not selling nothing. You're selling a business. The business will continue to exist, maybe for another 10 years, maybe for another 50. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really the key. So let's get back into your growth cycle. So tell me about the test cycle first. How would we go about, if we apply that to somebody who's new to Amazon or thinking about Amazon as a business model, how would we apply the test cycle to that Amazon as a business model?
Well, and we've already talked about this a little bit when we talked about successful failure, because that's principle number one, the first principle in the test cycle. And so I won't repeat what we talked about there. The second principle is bet on big ideas. And Bezos identifies in the shareholder letters three big ideas at Amazon. We've talked about one, which is marketplace. The second big idea is Prime. So Amazon Prime, free shipping, two-day shipping, and all of the other stuff you get with a Prime membership. And again, Prime was very controversial and very much nobody could figure out how Amazon could do it. So that was the second big idea. The third big idea at Amazon is Amazon Web Services. So taking what Amazon learned about managing their own computing infrastructure and then providing that as a service to others. I think one of the keys there to think about is, okay, if I'm going to be selling on Amazon, are there other things that I could do? So AWS is a great example of completely different business than e-commerce sales. And there are very few companies who successfully create a whole secondary or different part of their business that's completely different. And Amazon did with AWS. And so one of the questions I would say is, okay, are there things that we can do as that to diversify that risk, right? So now I'm not completely betting on just one stream of income. So I think there's some things there. And then I think the third principle in test is practice dynamic invention and innovation. And again, I sort of started talking about this, but the key there is, how are you incentivizing your employees to come up with better ways of doing what you do? And I think that that's a continuous process at Amazon. And in fact, every employee is expected to come up with ideas to improve their piece of Amazon, their process, whatever they're responsible for. You know, that could be a website button color. That could be a simpler way to, you know, support third-party sellers on marketplace. Who knows? I mean, there's literally thousands of different things that they come up with. But it's always coming from not a department, but within the culture itself. So as you're looking at starting, are you going to be able to build a culture like that? Or is it just going to be in your ideas? And frankly, that's limited. I don't care how smart you are, that's limited.
Yeah, right. I think a couple of examples, I mean, with my podcast, which is not an Amazon-based business, but it's derived from it. So I guess the equivalent to AWS would be maybe you can run a podcast or training, or a lot of people will develop the skill of selling their own physical products and then sell those skills to other companies who are great at producing good products, but right, aren't so great at Amazon. And also, and critically, aren't that interested either. I mean, they are interested in the sales, but they don't want to develop their own internal department that's dedicated to Amazon, because it's a bit too small for them to bother, for medium or large sized businesses, but it's big enough for them to know that they're missing out on some money. And if you can step in and offer those skills, quite a few people I know offer an agency type services. So that would be an idea, the equivalent of AWS. Yep. And what was that? What did you call that third principle? Practice dynamic something?
Dynamic invention.
Dynamic
and
invention.
Innovation.
Yeah, okay. So for invention me, and innovation. Okay.
Those are very specifically chosen words, because Bezos uses throughout the letters this phrase, we invent on behalf of the customer. And really the concept there is we're not looking at what the customers are asking us to do. We're looking at what we can do better for the customer. And so that's invention. That's something new. And I think, get the word invention and innovation messed up. Innovation is taking something you're doing and making it better. So the process is experimentation, invention, and then innovation.
That makes a lot of sense. And These things can be quite simple, by the way. Just say, I'm not sure that I even intended to create a culture of this originally, but I do now, which is to say that if you hire smart enough people, they'll make your processes better because they'll get fed up with working stupidly at them. So right. with the podcast editing, I was just going back and forth with Skype messages with my editor, Daniel, in America. Americans often greater innovation, I think. They're famously, it's part of the culture, I think, possibly more than in Europe, although more here than in the Far East, where mm-hmm. it's more about, copying, basically.
Yes.
And following mm-hmm. rigid systems. So, that's certainly I had an experience where Daniel just said, okay, I've set up an Airtable, which is a form of sort of
right.
task management, and I filled it in. And from there, I then fiddled around with it and made it better. So we've now got a really systematized way of running the process of the podcast, which was led not by me, but by the person doing the sort of sharp end of the work. And now with an assistant I've got in the Philippines, Shanice, I'm really trying to get her used to the quite anti-Filipino and anti-Asian idea of I'm going to ask you to do a rough draft of this and it's going to be wrong and then I'm going to edit it and then we're going to put it out there and see if it works. So I just wanted to point out that you don't need to be some big complicated company to have this approach. It can work on a very small scale. So I absolutely agree that has really, really helped, because otherwise you're just dependent on you being a genius for inventing things, and often that's not actually how it works. You're not necessarily the best person to innovate, you know?
Yeah. And I talk in the book about Thomas Edison, you know, Thomas Edison, obviously known as a great inventor, you know, over 1,000 patents to his name, but he had a team of 35 people who were doing experiments. And, you know, that to me is the model. And I call it the idea factory, right? How you know, kind of assembly line idea. And experimentation for Edison was huge in terms of coming up with the final light bulb or phonograph or, you know, all of the things that he's known for. But those were, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of experiments that led to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you just said, creating a sort of innovation factory, is when I look at the really successful Amazon businesses, more or less exactly what they do. They don't come up with a product, they come up with a process and a set of people who are really good at creating new product ideas and then sourcing and then getting it to market. So everything is process driven. So right. I really like what you said, an idea factory. I mean, that's more or less what I try and turn people into. People come to me mm-hmm. when they first want to create an Amazon business and they want to know what the killer product is they should sell. And I say, look, I can't just tell you offhand what that would be because it depends on you and who you are. So what I need to do is teach you the skill of figuring out what you know better than other people, and then how to turn those into product ideas, how to turn the product ideas into physical products through sourcing, and then how to launch those, which is not the hard bit. So in other words, I'm trying to teach people how to, you know, create a unique business. And if I just give you a product, it's no longer unique. Everyone else is doing the same thing with the same tools in China. You're just competing with big Chinese factories then. And I think you're done for. I think that the whole art is to figure out your own unique style, because otherwise there's nothing you have to offer that everyone else doesn't.
Yep, exactly.
And this is not a sort of self-actualization sort of woo-woo idea. It's about hard cash, because if your product's the same as everything else, it gets shopped on price and there's no profit left.
There's no profit. Yeah,
it's just as brutal as that. You know?
You're driving to the lowest price and lowest margin. So yeah, that's not a strategy.
Absolutely. So we talked about quite a few basic principles. Just to sort of wrap this episode up, how would we actually apply them then in the question of, you know, we've said about how can you assess the Amazon opportunity. We've talked a bit about that and evaluating risk. How would we make decisions after, say, a year? What would your sort of basic strategy be for that?
Well, I'm going to go to, again, one of the principles. It's in the Accelerate cycle, which is generate high velocity decisions. Okay. So decision making at Amazon is really interesting. And again, he talks about it several times in the shareholder letters, where at Amazon, they really have identified two different types of decisions. Type one decisions are big decisions. Those are big strategy, bet the farm type of decisions, where you need to be intentional, you need to be thoughtful, you need as much data as you are able to get. Type two decisions are quick decisions. As Bezos describes it, these are the kind of decisions that we can make and walk through the door of whatever that decision is. And if we look on the other side and don't like what we see, we can turn around and come back. Those decisions are easily reversible. And I think that's such a key idea, because as businesses grow, the decision-making process tends to move from type two, let's just quick decision, let's get it done, let's do it, to more type one decisions, where now we have multiple layers of approval, or, you know, we have to go through the supervisor and then the department head, or, you know, whatever that structure looks like. But anytime you slow down decision-making, you slow down growth. And for Bezos especially, that is a key way they have continued to accelerate growth, is they allowed decisions to be made at a lower level than most companies. And that goes, and this is an example where the principles interact with each other. So they're not just standalone, but that goes back to principle one, allowing people to fail, and allowing them to fail in areas that sort of don't matter. Because frankly, if the decision wasn't a good one, change it. You know, we'll pivot, we'll go something, do something else, and we learn from it. So high velocity decision making is a way to grow by not getting stuck in, you know, over analyzing something. In fact, Bezos says you should make decisions with at most 70% of the information you wish you had, because otherwise you're waiting too long. And that last bit of information, you could probably learn faster by moving forward than by waiting.
Yeah, excellent. This is very, very good advice, and this is good stuff to leave those who are thinking of getting into it with. I think the difference, the nuance that you've introduced here between the sort of just do it, take action thing, which is quite a common thing on podcasts, and I say that myself as well, but the difference between just take action and sit there analyzing everything to death is to differentiate between the two decisions, as you call it, the type one decisions, where you really should evaluate because it's betting the farm, and once you've gone there, mm-hmm. you can't reverse it, versus type mm-hmm. two. And I really think that's a very healthy distinction, because it, what it means is, this is exactly what we are talking about, calculated risk, right? So it's not a question of right. gambling, but it's not a question of overanalyzing tiny things. And my feedback is that the biggest problem that I see with newbie would be Amazon sellers is that they either never sell around anything because they treat type two decisions like, should I buy £1,000 worth of stuff after 3 months of spending maybe £1,000 with me on mentoring? I'm fairly cheap compared to a lot of other people, but it's not nothing. I often will say, look, you know, if we spend another 3 months of mentoring, you're going to spend that anyway. Why don't you just put that money out in the product and see what happens, you know, right. if you can limit your exposure. But the second thing is, I see that is less common, but sort of 20% of people actually take the leap and buy something. But quite often, and this is often before they come to see me, sadly, they've spent most of their capital on one product line that hasn't worked. But of course, that is a bet the farm situation, because if you have £10,000 to spend and you spend £8,000 on one product, you're betting the farm that it will work. And that's silly as well. So I guess the solution is find bets that are small enough that don't matter, and then get on with it. And that right. so aligns with the common sense approach that I see actually really works in real life. So that's brilliant to have that type one, type two distinction. I remember when I was running, training for a half marathon, while I was listening to your book, and that was a real aha moment. I thought, that's a really helpful distinction. So if you take home nothing else, I think that's really, really worth it. Just to flag up, folks, if you want to get the book with some nice bonuses and stuff, if you go to amazingfba.com/Bezos letters, if you can't spell Bezos let, you need to go and educate yourself, because this is the man who's going to affect your life if you spend your life on Amazon. But amazingfba.com/BEZOZOS letters, LETTERS. So Steve, thanks so much for coming on Amazing FBA podcast. So those of you who follow the 10K Collective podcast, be getting a bit of a deeper dive into the principles there as well. But for the moment, Steve, many thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.